the importance of getting predators off the street because they can prey on kids. And if you had done that overnight or wherever he'd been, he could have hurt someone. And that's just not acceptable.
This is the kind of gumshoe work, monotonous, determined work that good detectives have to do. And so wanting to be a good detective or federal investigator, I had to do it.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, we're back. We're back together. It feels like all is right with the world. Oh, wait a minute. No, the world's gone mad. But all
and we're not back together. Right, but we're not back together.
We can at least see each other.
We're on opposite ends of the United States of America. And, you know, Francie, I have to say, it's just not a bad situation. I'm sorry.
Stop it. Admit it. You miss my baked goods.
Your baked goods and sumo oranges. Absolutely. I miss those two things. So one of those things you have a great deal to do with.
The other, I don't.
Not really.
But I introduced you to the sumo.
You did. Actually, you did. And I will say that for several months a year, they changed my life.
Yes, agreed. 100%.
Anybody who hasn't yet enjoyed a sumo orange should. But they're only available, I think, till May, like January
like
till May.
February to May or something, yeah.
Yeah. And they're just wonderful things to
consume. Talk about nature's candy. It truly is.
Yeah. And the thing is that the skin just falls off of it, basically. It's not hard to peel. It's just... And they're very juicy and wonderfully delicious.
They're not a sponsor of ours, Jim. Right. Why are we giving them such a plug? But
because perhaps we will reach out to them and say, hey, we are your best advocates around the world.
We are.
Anyway, so today I'm going to shut up for a minute and let you actually kick this off.
This is shocking. Mm. Jim, I don't even know what to say. I don't even know what to do. No, I'm just kidding. Of course I can. I think, Jim, today, you're back in the hot seat.
Well, luckily it's a hot seat that's 3,000 miles away from you. But yes, I am in that hot seat.
You are lucky. And I just get giddy at the thought of being able to ask you questions and put you on the spot, Jim Clemente. And you have to answer them.
I know. The really sad thing is I don't have a judge to protect me or... Nope. Another attorney to object when you ask me objectionable questions, which I'm sure you will.
Of course, I like to. It's fun. So let's just start. Let's just do this thing. Here's what I want to know, Jim. Do you have a case to tell me about today?
I do.
Oh, this is so exciting. Okay, you had a really long career. I feel like I could almost make it a guessing game as to where you might have been in your career. But instead, I'll just ask you.
Wow. Wait a second. You're going to depart from your normal ask a question and supply only three answers that I have to choose from?
I do prefer that because it limits you, Jim. That's the point. It's all about control. Let's be honest.
Yes,
I'm feeling generous here in my own home state of Georgia. So I'm feeling generous. So let's just start with you telling me where you were in your career when this case came in.
I was at the very beginning of my FBI career. I had just graduated from the FBI Academy. I was sitting in a desk right across and face to face with Special Agent James Fitzgerald on the NYPD FBI Joint Bank Robbery Task Force. And I was raring to go. They called agents who were just out of the academy something like blue flamers because they kind of I don't know, they were trying to imply that maybe the new guys had a little bit of energy and had a blue flame shooting out their ass because they were trying to become super duper FBI agents. So,
you know, I just try to put myself back there with you and Fitz. Fitz is one of our favorite guests. We're going to have to get him on again. I know he's quarantining in the wilds of somewhere in the Northeast. So we're going to have to get him on here. He's had so many cases we can talk to him about. But I just try to imagine you and Fitz sitting across from each other on a bank robbery squad. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty cool because we were actually partnered with a couple of NYPD detectives, and we had maybe 20 people total on the squad, and we had 2,000 bank robberies that year in the city of New York. And so it was quite an active squad. Every day there would be bank robberies, and every day some or all of us would go out and respond to these bank robberies. And one day there was actually a robbery that we would interrupt, but that's for another time.
Oh, Jim, so full of teases. Okay, so there you are. You're on the bank robbery squad. You're barely wet behind the ears as a new FBI agent. You've got Fitz there. You're on the bank. Oh, one quick question. Is the bank robbery squad, are you actually co-located, as we would have called it, with NYPD detectives? Are you guys in the same offices?
Yes, the NYPD detectives are in the Federal Bureau of Investigations offices at 26 Federal Plaza, and we are working side by side with detectives. And I had the very distinct pleasure of working with both Detective First Grade Joseph Gelfand and Detective First Grade Chris Montanino. And both of these guys were, you know, by first grade in New York, that's the highest grade of detective. So you start off when you're a cop and then you become a detective. If you're lucky, you get your gold shield. That's a third grade detective. And then if over the course of your career, you do a lot of amazing stuff, you get up to second grade detective. And if you do outrageously fantastic and amazing work, you become a first grade detective. There are very few in the NYPD, and both Gelfand and Montanino were first grade detectives. So they had a lot of experience working the streets of New York. They knew the streets of New York. I knew the streets of New York because I lived there, grew up there, and I was very, very happy to be back in New York working as an FBI agent. But I also had a training agent. And well, just because I'm going to be pretty honest, I think I'll just use her nickname rather than her real name. And I'll tell you that her nickname was the Dragon Lady. And
I'm familiar with that name.
The reason why was because at the time, federal government buildings did not have prohibitions of smoking. So my training agent would sit there at her desk many times smoking 2 or 3 cigarettes at a time. We eventually bought her one of these devices that was actually an ashtray and a vacuum cleaner filter so that she could at least filter some of the smoke that she was putting in the squad area all day, every day. And what ended up happening was she would start smoking a cigarette, put it in the ashtray, get up and do something, light another cigarette, come back, have 2 cigarettes going, and then later have a third one going at the same time. And it was just ridiculous, the amount of smoke pouring out of her desk, which was right next to mine. So wow. I did not appreciate it. And I hate smoke. And I hate the fact that people smoke. I think it was disgusting. And I'm very happy that that has been outlawed. In fact, New York City was the first city in the country to outlaw smoking in restaurants. And eventually it got outlawed in bars. It got outlawed on airplanes, if you can believe it, Francie, back when you were just a wee lass.
There was a time. I'm not even sure I was a wee. I think I was a wee lass when they still allowed smoking in planes. You don't have to get on a plane
and be subjected to whatever number of hours of people smoking and smoking and smoking in that closed environment. It was horrible. However, let's get back to the topic at hand.
Let's get back to the topic at hand, Jim. You're always so distracted, Jim. Anyway, so there you are. You're on the bank robbery squad. There's 2,000 bank robberies in a year. So every day seems like it's going to be busy. What happens on this particular day about this particular case?
Well, to give you a little more detail about the bank robbery squad, it was also the violent crime and major offense squad, VCMO. And so we also, as FBI agents covered violent crimes and crimes against children. So to that end, we had multiple cases open all the time on various different subjects. And on this particular day, and this was in the first week or so of me becoming an FBI agent in the field, my training agent handed me a file. And she said, "You've never heard about this before, but there's a whole program called IO. I was like, "Yeah, you're right. I've never heard of that before. What is it?" And she says, "It's called Investigative Order, IO. And it is the sort of lead-in to the 10 most wanted fugitives of the FBI. In other words, there are a number of people who are on a list that are pending to become a top 10 FBI fugitive, but they're waiting for someone in the top 10 list to get arrested so that they can be taken off the list and the next one's moved up. So she tells me this is a file that's now an IO because they're going to make this guy the next top 10 fugitive as soon as the next top 10 fugitive is arrested. And they're specifically picking this guy because he's a child abductor and a child sexual victimizer who is a fugitive, and we want to get him locked up." And she said to me, "We've been hunting for him for 3 years. He's been on the lam." I said, "Wow, that's a pretty serious thing." My training agent then, like within a day or so, decides to take a class through the FBI Academy. And what that means is she volunteers herself to be assigned to the FBI Academy and to do basically be a senior agent to sort of guide the class, a new class of FBI agents through the FBI Academy experience. But that's in Quantico, Virginia, and we're in New York City. So she leaves to go to Quantico, and it's a 21-week program.
So your training agent is going to leave you alone for 21 weeks, even though you've been on the job for one.
Yes, exactly. And it was part of the MO of the Dragon Lady. She's done a number of other things to earn that title, and I could probably fill you in on a few of them. So my training agent leaves and leaves me with this file. And I notice in the file, there's a few things. There's a lot of paperwork about this offender's crimes. And I can tell you who the offender is because basically he was a known individual. He's a fugitive. In fact, I have his photo right here.
Oh, I'm looking at him. His name does not look like a nice person.
His name is Paul Noring. And the case number is 145C-4185. And if you, we'll just leave it at that at this point. And he is wanted for sex crimes against children and for abducting children and sexually victimizing them. And so he's somebody that we really want to get off the streets. He's a real danger to the community.
And at that point, Jim, had he been prosecuted or was he just wanted for prosecution?
At that time, he had been prosecuted and he had absconded post-conviction. I don't know the circumstances of how he absconded, but I imagine they let him out and expected him to return, and he did not.
You know, that happened to me a time or two, Jim. We'd be in the middle of trial and it'd be the morning of, say day two or day three of court. And I'd walk in and I'd be getting everything ready and waiting for the defendant and his attorney to arrive. The attorney would arrive without his client. And I'd look around the courtroom and I'd say, "Where's your client?" And he'd say, or she'd say, "Haven't seen him yet." And I'd say, "What do you mean you haven't seen him yet? Did you not arrange to come to court together today?" "We did, but he didn't show up." "Are you telling me I need to get a bench warrant in the middle of this trial?" "Let's give him another 15 minutes. So I'd have to tell the judge, "We're going to give him another 15 minutes, Your Honor." And of course, the judge huffs and puffs and says, "Well, I'm going to do a bench warrant and that person's not going to be out on bond anymore." But then, of course, a time or two, the defendant just never came back. Mm-hmm. And they can be tried in absentia. Once that trial is started, you can keep the trial going without the offender. Anyway, so this guy had absconded because some dummy let him out on bond, because sex offenders, in my humble opinion, should never be let out on bond, but that's just me. He'd been let out on bond, or he had been in the middle of trial, or after trial, he'd been given permission to surrender himself or whatever the circumstances were. And now you have him because he, of course, did not surrender himself.
Right. So I also looked in the file, and there was a bunch of information about associates and places he was known to have hung out and where he committed his crimes. And I began right away starting to familiarize myself with the file. And one of the things that I found in the file was a number of associates, let's say, that the FBI thought might know something about him. So I immediately set out to start to go out and find these people and interview them. And over the next several weeks, I did just that. I went out to different locations and tried to track down people that were listed on this list. And some of those were just wild goose chases. And some of them were actually people who I could identify and then actually interview. And I remember one particularly interesting person that I met was someone up in Harlem who I knocked on the door to talk to this gentleman. And he answered the door in his tidy whities. And it.
What?
Yeah.
In his underwear.
Wait,
for those of our listeners around the world who may not know the term tidy whities, that's that, the jockey shorts, the underwear. It's not boxers or boxer briefs, it's briefs.
Tidy whities. And he had a razor in his hand, a shaving razor in his hand. And not the open ones, but a regular, sort of Bic type razor. And he had shaving cream all over his upper legs, sorry. And his stomach area.
Mm-hmm.
And not to be put off by this, I said I'd like to talk to him. And we conducted, he asked me to step inside, which I did. And
wait, Jim. So you haven't even been an FBI agent probably a month or 6 weeks at this point. You have to tell us, what is going through your mind when someone opens the door with shaving cream all over their netherish regions, a razor in hand? What do you think? I mean, you have to think to yourself, this is not what I expected as an FBI agent.
I was thinking, okay, I guess this is what it's like being an FBI agent. So I went inside. He was very gracious, and he explained that he was in the middle of shaving his legs because he employed himself as a transvestite prostitute, and he had to shave his legs and his stomach area every day. So he was in the process of doing that, getting ready for work. And I just played it off as if this is something I experienced every day.
Well, so, I have to admit, on a personal note, in order to wear stockings or pantyhose, which most people do, if their employment has anything to do with dressing up, they often wear stockings or pantyhose, and one just can't have a bunch of hairy legs inside your stockings.
I suppose they can't. So I stood up for the interview because he was standing up, and he proceeded to shave his legs while we were talking. And he was totally nonplussed by the fact that an FBI agent had knocked on his door. So I talked to him about what he did for a living. I built rapport. I found out a lot of other information before I got around to the subject of Paul Noring. And when I did, it was kind of clear that there was a level of concern on his part when I raised that issue. And I said, look, I don't have any information right now that you're in any trouble, but certainly if you know where he is and you're hiding him or hiding the information from me now that I've knocked on your door and you so politely answered while you were shaving your legs, I would have to say that you could be in a lot of trouble if you do help him continue to be a fugitive. You do understand what he's wanted for. Oh, yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. Yes. Okay. So in the process of discussing this, I asked him, when was the last time you saw him? And he did say that it predated our interview, but that it seemed to be sometime after he went on the lam. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. Where were you? And he said, I have to admit, I have no idea exactly where we were. And that didn't sound right to me. And I pressed him a little, and he said, I do have a picture of him that he gave me. And I said, oh, well, this is after he's on the lam? And he said, well, I guess, you know, I didn't know that he was a fugitive at the time, but I believe you that he is. And I said, okay, well, let's see that picture. And he hands me a Polaroid picture. And the Polaroid picture had Paul Noring in it very clearly. And there was a guy with his arm around his shoulder. And, you know, they looked like they were friends. And I said, okay, do you know who this guy is? And he said, no, I don't know who he is. But in the background behind these two people, Paul Noring and this other unknown individual, there was a big plaque, almost like a logo for a company. And I could see the letters that looked like part of an M, P, O, R, T, and part of an S in between their heads in the back. So it looked like it was Something Imports as the name of a company. So
that's like a clue, Jim.
I would think so. And me being a young FBI agent, I definitely thought it was a clue. So you know what I did, Francie? You want to know.
I do want to know.
I went back to the FBI office with this clue, and I took out the business yellow pages.
Oh, my God.
For Manhattan, which was quite a lofty document. I mean, I would say 10,000 pages. And so what I did was I went through the entire yellow pages for Manhattan, because he did say that it was somewhere in Manhattan. I went through the entire yellow pages and started flipping through them and looking for every company in Manhattan that had imports in the name.
But Jim, that you're talking about something that took not just hours, that had to take maybe not even just days, but possibly weeks.
It took a few weeks. And I have to say that this was 1988.
Wow, 1988. I was a wee lass then, Jen.
So in 1988, there was no such thing as the interwebs. Okay? No. Didn't exist.
Nope,
so
not for us.
We had to do this kind of work by hand. There was no computer database I could go search or anything. I had to do this by hand. So page by page by page, I went down with a pencil and checked off each one, circled them, put them on a list, and the phone number of the company, address and phone number. I wrote all that out. By the end of a few weeks, I had a list on a legal pad of literally hundreds of different names, hundreds of different companies with imports in it. And now it's time for me to set out and do something about it.
Okay, so I have two questions, as you might guess. Number one, did you feel a little defeated at the thought of setting out and looking into that many companies?
I had a blue flame shooting out my ass. I was a new FBI agent. I was going to find this dangerous fugitive if it was the last thing I ever did. So okay. I knew that it could take a long time. Might take me my entire career, but I was going to go through every name on that list.
Okay, so that brings me to question number two, which I would ask you at the end, but I'm afraid I'm going to forget. So I'm just going to ask you now. If you looked back on new agent James Clementi, from your profiler view, from all that you learned as a profiler about interviewing, how do you judge yourself on your interview with that gentleman?
Well, I will say this. I was actually a little shocked and put off by the fact that he answered the door in his underwear and was shaving his legs. And then also very impressed by the fact that he was nonplussed by it. The fact is, he knew who he was, and he was not embarrassed or put off by the fact that an FBI agent was standing there in front of him and that he was being interviewed about a dangerous sex offending fugitive. So all this was kind of matter of fact to him. And I think that actually helped me be matter of fact about it. So in a way, this was a real good learning experience for me, because I realized through this process that me not reacting overtly to his presence or the fact that he was very open about the fact that why he was doing what he was doing I think that really helped me to understand that when you're, and the effectiveness of the interview, it helped me to understand that if you really want to be effective, you can't be outraged or you can't be judgmental. And I think that was a really good lesson. And I think it's a lesson that I've taught other law enforcement professionals when I was teaching interview and interrogation techniques.
Okay, so you have this massive list that you've taken weeks to compile. And now you're going to literally go gumshoeing around New York to try to figure out whether these businesses know the fugitive, because it could have been just happenstance. I mean, did that ever occur to you while you're doing this, is that they just maybe that your fugitive and the guy with him, Noring and the guy with him, just happened to be standing in front of a logo, but they have nothing to do with that business? All that work could be for nothing.
Absolutely. And there was going to be a hell of a lot more work to come. That could be for nothing. Yes, but that's just the kind of thing you have to do. It's like searching for parking tickets when the Son of Sam is out there killing people. That's how he was actually caught. So this is the kind of gumshoe work, shoe leather work, the kind of monotonous, determined work that good detectives have to do. And so wanting to be a good detective or federal investigator, like I was, I had to do it. So on this particular day that I decided to start out, I made two decisions that would end up being very helpful. One is that I said to Jim Fitzgerald, hey, are you doing anything? You want to come out and, we called it, shag some leads with me? And he was like, ah, okay. And he puts on his jacket and I put on my jacket and we walk out like two FBI agents and we go down to the basement, we get in our car, and I said, I have this whole list. And he was like, what? He's like, you're not planning on doing that whole thing today, are you? And I said, no, but we'll just start. I'll tell you what, we'll start closest to home. So we go over to the South Street Seaport, which is just at this time in the, late 80s, it was just starting to go through sort of a resurgence and a revival. And they put in some restaurants and nightclubs and bars, and you know, young people from Wall Street would come there after work to party and celebrate and blow off steam. So it was quite a lively area, but it was still an active seaport. And so I went to the first name on the list, which was something, something Imports. And it was in South Street area, which is literally just blocks away from 26 Federal Plaza, where we worked in the FBI. So I figured we'd start there and then work our way uptown. And so we pull into the loading dock and parked our FBI vehicle. And this is like, one of the first times I'm ever being an official FBI agent going to a business. So I'm all pumped up and I see the name of the place and it was something, something Imports. And although it didn't look like the plaque that I saw in the background of this photograph that I had, I, nevertheless, walked up the steps to the loading dock, asked one of the workers who runs the place, and they said, oh, the president's office is on the second floor. Just take that elevator. So Fitz and I get into the elevator and push two and goes up to the second floor. And two things are immediately obvious when the door opens. One, the plaque that was in that picture is on the wall right outside of that elevator.
No way, at the first place you go?
And two, the guy in the picture is walking towards us, asking us, how can I help you, sir?
This is fiction, Jim. It is absolutely true.
It was amazing. So I said to the guy, remember learning not to be like overly outwardly reactive. I said to the guy, yes, can you take me to the president's office? I need to speak to him right away. And Fitz knows nothing really about the case, right? He's just tagging along to be my sidekick. So we look at each other like I'm showing him the picture. We look at each other. We go to the president's office. I say to this guy, hold on, don't go anywhere. I say to the president, I need your office right now. And I need to talk to him. So if you could give us some time, please. And the president's like, okay. He gets up and he walks out and he closes the door.
Wow.
I have the guy sit at the desk and I said, please tell us your name. And he tells us his name. I said, please tell us your position here. He tells us his position there. I tell him where, I ask him, what's your home address? I'm just asking him all these generic pieces of information and he's complying, but you could tell he's getting very nervous. Fitz is sitting over there in the chair, not knowing what to say or do. So he just kept quiet. And this guy keeps looking at Fitz. And then I said to him, sir, we're here on very important matter. And how you respond to us is going to determine what happens to you for the rest of your life. I want you to be completely aware of that. And he just, you know, swallows and he's nervous and so forth. And I was very calm, but I just said, I'm going to show you a picture. And I would like you to identify the other person in that picture. And I would like you to tell me where he is. And I slid the picture over. He didn't even touch it. He was like recoiling back from it.
Like it has cooties.
Yes. And he said, well, I think his name is Paul, but I have no idea who he is or where he is. I said, really? It's interesting. Because you're probably wondering where I got this picture. Because the person who I got this picture from, and here I engaged in what we call a little obfuscation, which is totally, as long as I'm not coercing somebody or, you know, forcing them to lie to me or something like that, this is totally legitimate in an interrogation. I said, the person that I gave this to me told me a very different story.
Yo, hiring can be difficult. But if you're a company that's currently trying to hire, you face new difficulties, from safely reopening your doors to finding the right person for a specialized role. HousingWire could relate. They needed to hire an ambitious reporter to cover news stories on the U.S. mortgage and housing markets, so they turned to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's smart matching technology finds people with the right experience for your job. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And that's how HousingWire found Alexandra Roja. Alexandra never imagined she could get a reporter job in the midst of COVID-19. Hiring was frozen. The idea of looking for a job was discouraging. So she created a profile on ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter matched Alexandra to HousingWire's reporter job because her degree and writing skills were a great fit for the role. HousingWire received her application only 4 hours after they posted the job. And a few weeks later, Alexandra started her dream career. ZipRecruiter helped Alexandra find the right job, and they helped HousingWire find the right person for their role fast. See how ZipRecruiter can help you hire. Try it now for free at ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. That's ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And he said, well, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't know anything about this guy. I don't know anything. I don't. And then the phone rings and he picks up the phone and answers it.
In the president's office?
In the president's office. And I said, well, he was pretty high up in this company. So he felt he should answer the phone. So as he's answering the phone, I turned to Fitz and I said, can you please like get in his face a little bit? You know, I whispered that to him. Fitz is like, all right. And so he's talking.
Fitz has been a street cop, so he's tough.
Yeah. He's a very experienced police officer before he became an FBI agent. And so I said that to Fitz. And the guy hung up the phone. And as he's putting the phone in the cradle, Fitz stands up, pounds both of his hands on the desk and says, God damn it, you're lying to us. And I was like, okay, I think Fitz is going a little overboard. So I kind of grabbed Fitz around the shoulders and I was like, all right, calm down. And I said, let's have a seat. You know, let's not get too much into his face. And the guy said, what if I tell you what I know?
Wow. Fitz is very intimidating, apparently.
And I said, well, if you tell us everything you know and you're completely honest and you have nothing to do with this sex offender wanted fugitive, then everything will be fine. So he proceeds to tell us that 2 months earlier, he had opened a imported goods store on, I believe it was 61st Street and 2nd Avenue in Manhattan, and that Paul Noring was the store manager.
You mean the guy he doesn't really know and certainly doesn't know where he is?
That guy. And he said, he's there now. And so I said, I'm going to explain something to you very clearly. The phones here are tapped. We will be watching your vehicle. If we go up there and he's no longer there, we will be coming for you. We will arrest you for obstruction of justice and for harboring a fugitive, and things will not go very well for you. So I suggest you continue doing what you just did now, which is be honest and stay out of this, or else this is not going to be good for you. And he said, oh, no, I won't say anything. Are you going to say something to my boss? And I said, the only thing I'm going to say to your boss is that you were very helpful. But if anything changes, I will tell your boss everything. He said, I won't say a word. Fitz and I hurry downstairs. We ran down the stairs instead of waiting for the elevator, get in our car, and we're driving north on 2nd Avenue.
And of course, there's no cell phones. So it's not like you can call anyone and say, hey, you know, post up at this location.
No, we didn't even know if he'd actually be there. So we just thought, okay, well, we immediately hop in our cars and we drive uptown. And we just thought, you know, well, let's see if he's there. And so we drive uptown. And at this point, it's getting, you know, there's all sorts of traffic. I don't know if you've ever driven in Manhattan in the middle of the day, but let me tell you, there was a lot of traffic. So there were times when I literally drove up on sidewalks and, you know, used my siren, did all sorts of crazy things because I was an FBI agent going after a dangerous fugitive. And so we get up to 61st Street, and I remember driving by and looking to my left and going by the address and seeing this brand new, you know, storefront painted white with the name on it and big glass windows, just all glass front. And sitting at the back of the shop, filled with leather goods, bags and briefcases and so forth, is Paul Noring. And so I immediately pulled over to the right. And I said, Jim, let's put together an arrest plan. How about I go in, I'll start talking to him. I'll make sure he's facing away from the door. And then you come in a few minutes later. And when he addresses you, would you please pull out your credentials, tell him you're FBI, and that's when I'll be putting the cuffs on him. And he's like, sounds like a plan, let's go. So I go in and I'm talking to Paul Noring. And I'm literally 2 feet away from him, and I'm asking him about leather briefcases and what's the best leather and where is this from and all this stuff. And I make sure that
preparing for your undercover role that would come sometime later.
Yes. One of them. Yes. And then I made sure that he was facing me towards the back of the store, and Fitz comes in and the little bell rings. So he turns around to Fitz, and Fitz says, hi. And he says, I'll be with you in a few moments. He goes, great. But can I just show you something first? And he said, yeah. And Fitz takes out his credentials and said, FBI, you're under arrest, Paul Noring. And at that point, I grab his hands. He just, his jaw drops. I put the cuffs on. I walk him to the back. And there's a phone there. And he is just in shock, like in shock. He has no idea what happened, how this happened. But now he realizes he's in federal custody again. And so go to the back of the store, and there's a phone, and I pick up the phone and I call the squad. And I said, and Chris Montanino, detective first grade, Chris Montanino answers. And I said, hey, Chris. He goes, Jim, where are you? John Coleman, our squad supervisor, wants to know where the hell the gyms are. That's what they called us, the gyms.
The gyms.
And I said, oh, well, we were out shagging leads on the Paul Noring case, and I just arrested him. So where do we take him? And he goes, stop fooling around. No, really, John wants to know where you are. And I said, Chris, we just arrested Paul Noring. We're at 61st and 2nd Avenue. We just arrested him, and we want to know what we're supposed to do next. You know, where are we supposed to take him? And he goes, just bring him down to the federal court and book him. And I'm like, book him in the federal court. Don't we have to like fingerprint him and photograph him? And don't we get to interrogate him? I mean, I was looking forward to this. And he said, really, stop fooling around. I'm going to tell John. And I said, yeah, that's why I called. Tell John we just arrested Paul Noren. And he goes, what? And then he kind of disappears. And then all of a sudden, John Coleman gets on the phone. You did what? I said, we arrested Paul Noren. Get your asses back here now.
That sounds like you're in trouble.
I was like, whoa, that's not the exact response that I expected.
No, which should have been more like, congratulations, you guys are heroes.
Well, Francie, some things are different in the FBI. So we drove him back to the FBI building. We drove into the basement. We took him up the secure elevator to the floor below where our squad was, because that's where the fingerprinting and interrogation rooms were. And we brought him into an interrogation room, and we took one handcuff and hooked it to the rail like we were supposed to, and seated him in a seat. And Fitz and I were just kind of nervously waiting. And sure enough, our squad supervisor, John Coleman, rolls down the hallway with steam coming out his ears. And
just
so
cannot imagine why.
So he looked in, saw Noren, saw that he was, he was securely handcuffed, closed the door, took us about 10 feet away and said, what the fuck do you think you were doing? That guy was an IO. It's the whole entire unit should have been out for that arrest. What were you two rookies doing? And Fitz is like, with all due respect, I am a detective sergeant from a police department before I was an FBI agent. He was a prosecutor before he was an FBI agent. It's not like we didn't know what we were doing. And I was like, but John, my training agent told me that he was a really important fugitive and you've been looking for him for 3 years. So we found him. So we arrested him. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to do? And he just like blew up and then stormed away. Whew, that was a little weird. But luckily, the bank robbery coordinator, Steve, came down, knocked on the door, took us outside and said, don't listen to John. You guys did great work. We've been looking for him for 3 years. He needed to be off the street immediately. Great job. So aww, that was a little better. So we then proceeded to photograph and fingerprint Paul Noren. And what I didn't know was this is the very day that my training agent would return from Quantico.
Oh, dear.
So apparently what I also didn't know was what they told her upstairs. But what I did see was after we had finished photographing and fingerprinting him, I was kind of leaning against the open door, looking down the hallway towards the elevators. And here I see the Dragon Lady approaching. And she was every bit of the Dragon Lady at that point, because there was smoke coming out of her ears from the anger and smoke coming out of her mouth from the cigarette she was puffing away.
Uh-oh.
On. So she came up to me, and instead of addressing me or saying hi or anything like that, she basically backhands me with her right palm as she turns into the room and sees Paul Noren. And then she takes this deep breath. She falls back against the door and almost slides down to the floor and says, oh, my God, Paul. And he said, do I know you? And she said, no, but I feel like I know you. I've been looking for you for 3 years.
Not well.
Thank you. So it turns out that Chris Montanino kind of gigged her a little bit upstairs and said, oh, it's a good thing you're back today, because the gyms, you know, you're supposed to be their training agent, and they just went out and arrested some crazy guy. They arrested the wrong guy.
And so she comes steaming in thinking you've arrested the wrong guy, and then she sees you did not arrest the wrong guy.
I did not arrest the wrong guy. And so, you know, she got a little giddy and a little more helpful after that point. We booked him. We processed him. We locked him up in Metropolitan Correctional Facility across the street, where he stayed until he was actually sent to prison. I never got to see him again, which I thought I would, but I didn't. And that was kind of a letdown, because I thought we'd at least get to, like, there would be another sentencing or something like that. But he was just remanded and he went off. This would be the same prison that Mr. Jeffrey Epstein would commit suicide in. And
Jim's using scare quotes again when he says committed suicide.
Scare quotes. I don't know. I call them air quotes, but whatever. Anyway, the point is that he went away, and I later found out that what my supervisor had wanted us to do was find him and then wait until he became a top 10 so that he could go out and arrest a top 10 fugitive.
Wow.
That's what I heard. True or not, I don't know, but that's what I heard.
Bureaucratic. And, you know, Jim, you and I have talked many
times.
And risky. Well, that's right. You and I have talked many times about the importance of getting predators, I know you don't like that word, off the street because they can prey on kids. And if you had done that overnight or wherever he had been, he could have hurt someone. And that's right. Just not acceptable. And you know that.
But the thing about calling him a predator was that he was a soft-spoken, very polite, congenial person who dealt with the public every day at the same time as he was a wanted, violent felon. Somebody who abducted and sexually assaulted children, a real danger to the community, was literally in the community every day, just addressing people on the Upper East Side of Manhattan as if it was, you know, no big deal. So nobody
hiding in plain sight.
No, right. Hiding in plain sight because people were looking for a predator and he did not appear to be a predator. So even though he was. So anyway, it was a very interesting experience. And I will have to say, luck kind of played a huge role in how this all came together. But I'm so happy it did because I got my first arrest under my belt, and I have a lot of really great learning experiences that I took to heart through that investigation.
Well, so that brings us to the big question, which I think I know the answer to, but was this a best case or a worst case, Jim Clementi?
It was definitely a best case because I was able to help get a very dangerous felon off the street, a child sex offender. I prevented him from ever getting to the top 10 list of the FBI's most wanted, but I did it because I wanted to prevent this from happening to other kids. So I know it was the right thing to do. However, I will say this, that my training agent used some very manipulative paperwork to give me the locate for Paul Noering, but no credit for the arrest. And that was... It was not, she said, oh, I did it. I gave Jim Fitz the arrest, even though it wasn't his case, had nothing to do with the investigation except coming with me that day. I mean, he was very helpful. There's no question about it. And had he not been there that day, I probably would have called the squad. But I knew that together we had literally just finished the FBI Academy where we did arrest procedures together. So I knew that we could work in tandem and we did, and it was the right thing to do. But it just pointed out to me that there are people in the FBI in various positions who are more concerned about themselves than they are about the FBI in general or people that are sort of under their command or instruction. So it was a lesson in a lot of ways, but it certainly was one of the best cases of my career.
Wow, Jim, that was fantastic. I don't feel like I got to cross-examine you as much as I would have liked, but one good thing came out of it.
Yeah.
The title of this episode is definitely going to be The Gems.
Oh, I thought it was going to be The Dragon Lady, but thank you.
No, The Gems. Definitely The Gems.
Okay.
That's fantastic, Jim. And, you know, you have got a very long and distinguished case file vault that I feel certain we'll dip into again. But this was a good one. I can't wait to talk to Fitz about it and ask Fitz to come on and talk about one of his own other cases that maybe was another... The Gems case.
There were a few of those. I can say that.
I can't wait.
Well, thank you, Francie. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of Best Case, Worst Case. Until next time, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.